Hello and welcome to this episode of Voices of World Christianity. I'm Noam and we're here with Pew, and our special guest for today is our good friend Easton Law. Easton, would you like to introduce yourself and say a little bit more about who you are, where you're working, etc., etc.?
Great. Well, thank you so much for this invitation, Noam. My name is Easton Law and I serve as the Assistant Director for Academic Programs at the Overseas Ministries Study Center at Princeton Theological Seminary. I know that's a mouthful. We go by the acronym OMSC, OMSC at PTS, but I know that can still be confusing because there are other World Christianity Mission Studies organizations with the same letters, and it can get a little bit confusing. So OMSC at PTS, and I've been here for about 2 years now, I'm just very thankful for this opportunity to be able to speak with both of you about questions and trends and in world Christianity.
Great. Thank you for joining us. So looking at the articles and stuff that you've sent us and the kind of research that you do, it seems like your interests are a little bit kind of spread out all over the place. Like, I've got world Christianity, qualitative research, lived theologies, Asian American stuff. Like, do you see yourself, you know, do you place yourself in any particular field, or are you quite happy to float around, and what interests you?
I would say that first, I am happy to float around. I find the academy a little too siloed for my liking. Words and terms need definitions, of course, but when they're defined too rigidly, you really lose opportunities for creativity and synergy. And in the real world, things are messy. And I think disciplines need to be a little bit messy too, in order to facilitate the kind of innovation and new sort of perspectives that particularly a field like world Christianity needs. So I would say that in that long list of things you shared, I do see myself primarily as a world Christianity scholar, with that recognition that world Christianity is a multidisciplinary and increasingly interdisciplinary space where scholars are willing to not just look at the world church from different disciplinary perspectives, but also are willing to say, well, what happens when I mix disciplinary perspectives? What will I see? Will I see something different than if I only used one lens? So I would say that that's my reason for loving to float around. Asian Americans are part of the world church. People doing theology and qualitative research within the field of practical theology are part of the world church. And so that's why I like to sit in the world Christianity bucket, recognizing that it's a big open bucket.
That's great. Thanks for explaining that, Easton, and good to connect with you again. I think the one area, or there are many other sections as well, but the one area where all of our research, three of us, kind of intersect is on qualitative research. And I wonder if you could talk a bit more about that. And I think also just to interject, you talk about three-lane roads in some of your metaphors in talking about this method in world Christianity. Can you expand on that and also by way of that, explain what you really mean by qualitative research?
Sure thing. This does build on what I said earlier in the sense that the disciplines have in the academy have tended to be siloed. And there's a benefit to that silo because it creates precision. It creates depth. And I wanted to share that because it's not as if I think disciplines are not necessary. But I do think there are seasons in scholarship and in inquiry. And to build on the metaphor that you referenced, it's a metaphor I've used in some lectures, and I think it's in my article on theology and qualitative research in world Christianity. When I was introduced to the field of world Christianity by Dr. Dana Robert at Boston University, she was so helpful and so generous with me and really brought a disciplinary lens to it, though. She said, most people who join the field of world Christianity come in as a historian, a social scientist, or a theologian. Mm-hmm. And as a not even a prospective doctoral student, I was like, oh, okay, I'm going to have to pick one of these, you know. And she's not wrong. If you look at the field of world Christianity, generally, people have been historians, social scientists, and theologians, and have generally stayed in their lane, you know, the same. And so I had this picture of a three-lane highway. The highway is going in the same direction, which is the study of the world church. But, you know, you pick a lane and you generally stay within it. You're trained in historical method. You're trained in social scientific method. You're trained in theological method. And the reason I like the three-lane metaphor is of three-lane highway metaphor is because the lanes are, in fact, porous. If you're on a three-lane highway, you can move between lanes. You know, no one's going to stop you. But it is helpful to stay in one lane, right? And I think what's happened is because the disciplines have been so great at what they're designed to do, which is create depth, that as younger scholars, we don't know if we can go any deeper sometimes within the historical study, within the social scientific study. And not only that, I think as younger scholars, we find that the depth limits new questions, as I've alluded to before. So what happens if we can switch lanes more often? You know, yes, we'll be trained in a particular set of things, but, you know, social scientists are constantly drawing from historical work. You know, historical work draws from social scientific work, and that's pretty that's become a very fluid lane. I feel like they go back and forth pretty regularly. But what I have found is that the theologian is the least likely to change lanes. At best, they will swerve into history to pick up some information and then quickly go back because theology has a particular, it's been disciplined into a certain way of thinking that's uncomfortable with thick empirical data at times. And that's why I think the next big step in world Christianity is sort of a more interdisciplinary look at theology in particular.
Yeah, I think I'm seeing that as well, just kind of even in the past few years as I've been in the field of world Christianity, there's more and more people that I encounter are engaging with social scientific methods or qualitative methods for their theology. So like lived theology, practical theology, autoethnography, all that kind of stuff is like coming forward, I think, within the theological world in which I'm situated. And I wanted to ask, like, why do you think that is? What in your opinion, explains the growing interest in using qualitative methods within world Christianity or within theology?
What explains the interest?
Or perhaps it's easier for you to say what explains your interest in.
Right. Well, yeah. And of course, we always start with our own perspective and experience, right? So that's exactly what I was just pondering.
Oh my God.
And for me, and, you know, as young scholars as well, you can affirm or, you know, adjust what I'm sharing based on your own experience. I think because world Christianity is a three-lane highway that is already porous, you go to these conferences, you know, as a young student of the field or of the approach, and you hear all three perspectives from panel to panel, from keynote to keynote. You know, sure, each one is well-disciplined in their perspective, but I'm hearing this great perspective from this historian. Now I'm going to go to this next panel, and suddenly there are three social scientists talking about their work in the field. And then I go to another panel, and there's somebody reflecting theologically. And so that multidisciplinary space for a young scholar makes you think, well, what's the connection between them? Because you don't hear the senior scholars making the connections between them as explicitly. For me, I didn't hear those explicit connections, but I was hearing all three perspectives. So naturally, I was like, I wonder what you can do with these in a different arrangement. And so it's almost a natural byproduct of the space that we're in. And that's my experience. I don't know about the two of you.
I think for me, I just like talking about myself. So so qualitative research methods allows me to kind of draw on from my own experiences. I mean, I say that as a joke, but also like, I think particularly within world Christianity, there's probably certain areas that are so understudied that you have no recourse but to draw on the people on the ground, whether that's yourself, your family networks, et cetera, et cetera, and say, you know, how are you thinking about your faith in this context? Like, let's talk about that and let's explore that more in more depth. Sorry to you, did you have a question?
No, I mean, I totally agree with that. I think in my context, it's more to do with, for lack of a better term, the absence of resources. Like, we don't have text, we don't have discourse happening. And so the easiest or the most logical thing would be to retrieve through social scientific methods, observations and phenomenology, those kinds of things. So I think it also, yeah, it's kind of a method of desperation, so to say. But I think it's got its value and it's got its strength. Like you said, there are possibilities that are opened up, I think, with a new approach.
Well, one response I have to both of you sharing this perspective of lack of resources, I think, is a turn in world Christianity that I'm just super excited about and is a lot about. It's a lot of what OMSC is trying to build on. OMSC's sort of mission statement is to amplify the voices of the world church, you know, not to speak on behalf of the world church, not to create more resources for the world church, but to amplify existing voices. And what I mean by that is world Christianity as a field, you know, it's adjacent to the ecumenical movement and the mission studies sort of movement, but those are largely, you know, European endeavors, you know, North Atlantic endeavors, Global North endeavors. And nothing inherently wrong with that. But as world Christianity has expanded, the actual voices of people from these places are maturing, are strengthening. You know, so as a result, they know so much more about their context. You both know so much more about your cultural church contexts than any outsider coming to study it would. So an outsider coming to study Christianity in North India or in Northeast India or in, you know, in parts of Myanmar, they're collecting information and they'll publish it from that outsider perspective, which helps other outsiders understand it. But as an insider, you come that all that stuff's elementary to you, you know? So you're looking for those deeper resources. And guess what? They're not written because there haven't been as many, you know, Burmese and Northeast Indian world Christianity scholars going that deep. So suddenly, what are you going to do? You have to go to the qualitative research and bring it out yourself. But that is fantastic for world Christianity and is a big part of what OMSC wants to do is you should have every opportunity to articulate thick, you know, descriptions, both sociologically and theologically from your context. It's time for us to really learn from insiders rather than sophisticated and, you know, humble, educated outsiders. But there's just a shift in that quality of information. So when you say, you know, I need better information, I got to go get it myself, that makes 100% sense to me.
Yeah, so I just want to go deeper on that, the connection between world Christianity and, say, practical theology or qualitative research. And from what I'm hearing, from what you're saying here, you're clearly suggesting that there has to be more connections in the first place, but there's also a need for academic theology, so to say, to lean into scholars in the majority world and learn in the methods. And I absolutely agree with you. And I read your article, Theological Research and World Christianity, I think, for the handbook that you sent us, in which I think you were addressing more practical theologians in there, where you mentioned that the next step for world Christianity is to explore qualitative research. And I see what you're doing there, but I think you'll definitely agree that it's slightly problematic that the resource, again, lies with those who are based in the West, like practical theologians. And it seems to almost diminish the agency of those in the majority world who are already like involving in qualitative research, you know what I mean? So for example, if I talk about the Naga context, any monograph on Christianity among the Nagas, theological or otherwise, you'll find 2/3 of that would be social scientific content, like history and political analysis, socioeconomic discussion, even like geography, like land and what's the extent of the land and all of that. Well done, terribly done, that's another question, right? But I think historically it's been a struggle and wrestling with the lived and experience reality. So I absolutely want to echo what you're saying and affirm that there's definitely a need for reciprocity in this between practical theologians and world Christianity. So I think that's a very interesting conversation to be had.
Yeah, I think the article that I wrote for the handbook on theology and qualitative research was generally directed at practical theologians.
Yeah.
Right. And I wrote it very mindful that for the most part, practical theology is a very global north sort of paradigm. And it has everything to do with the genealogy of the theological academy. Schleiermacher, you know, as he literally built the architecture for some for theological disciplines was like practical theology here, you know, systematic theology here and whatnot. And as a result, in the North Atlantic and the global North, practical theology is like different than other forms of theology. When I would venture to argue that practical theology is just theology in a lot of the global South. And so when they are brought into the North Atlantic, global North disciplines, they are in fact disciplined out of a holistic theology. They are disciplined into thinking, are you a constructive theologian or are you a practical theologian? When they said, well, I mean, I'm a theologian, right? I mean, this is what I perceive. But they get disciplined into a specific niche of theology. And some of this, I think, has to do with the economy of the academy. What the more prestigious thing tends in theology tends to be systematic, maybe historical. For whatever reason, practical theology isn't always seen as very prestigious. And so when people, when scholars from the Global South are thinking about what will give them the most cachet, not only in the Global North, but also in their home context, they think, I need to get a systematic theology degree. You know, they don't think I'm going to get a practical theology degree, in parts because maybe their seminaries don't have practical theology departments often. So there's an economy and an architecture to the theological academy that that disciplines Global South theologians out of that holism is part of my read on it.
I see.
And so when I look at why does world Christianity need to look at practical theology in this sort of global North-centric paradigm of practical theology, it's because practical theology as a global North discipline has as what this is what disciplines do, right? I guess I keep coming back to that. They have worked really hard to create more precise tools. You know, that's sort of what the gift of the North Atlantic global North Academy does. They just it's just not enough though. You know, they create these really great tools, but then they use these tools within their constrained contexts. And then they universalize their findings using great tools from a constrained context. And I think what world Christianity scholars can do, especially those that want to be theologians, but also social scientists, is you take these tools, you go to your own context, you know, in Nagaland or northern parts of Myanmar, and you use them, and then if the tools work, you're going to find different things. Just because you have a tool doesn't mean you find the same thing everywhere. Mm-hmm. You're going to find a whole different thing. But secondly, you might find the tool doesn't work that well. And then you're able to change the tool in a way that your normal North Atlantic, you know, practical theologian would never think to do. Because they keep using it in their own contexts, you know, congregations in North America and Europe. And so I think the gift of practical theology for world Christianity is really that they've shaped great tools that world Christianity has been reluctant to use because they're a little messy. You know, they're not theological or social scientific. They're somehow both. And that's where they can learn from each other.
So I was struck by when I was reading that handbook chapter about how you were saying that the diversity of world Christianity makes it I'm just quoting you directly, makes it an ideal platform for advancing conversations about the relationship between theology and qualitative research. If I could ask a slightly controversial question, is world Christianity the answer to all of theology's problems?
I would say it's a laboratory for exploring all of those questions.
Mm-hmm.
In more effective ways than somewhere else, which is a really awkward way of saying yes, it's the answer to
come on, put a definitive statement down.
Right?
You heard it here, folks.
As scholars, we're endlessly trying to qualify our statements so there aren't, you know, little loopholes that can be chopped down or whatnot or crawled through. But if I were to expand on the convoluted answer, is I keep coming back to this disciplinary thing, right? World Christianity is inherently multidisciplinary.
Mm-hmm.
And in order to answer some of these questions that we have about the world church, you need multiple disciplines.
Mm-hmm.
And this is why world Christianity, for me, is the right space to seek answers. Does world Christianity have all the answers? No. To theology. But is world Christianity the right place to seek answers? Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And this has to do with, again, my sense of how there's a season for every season has different needs.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think the theological disciplines are too disciplined and they're too siloed. There's been good that's come out of that, but you can't keep doing it that way.
Mm-hmm.
You also have to bring it back together. And so we're entering a season where world Christianity is this great platform for bringing it together. But give it another 50, 60, 100 years, it might be time to go back to siloed discipline thinking because it's gotten too messy and we need more precision.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not saying we always need to be multidisciplinary. We always need to be interdisciplinary. I'm saying I think in this season of theology, we need it.
Mm-hmm.
And world Christianity is the best platform for it.
I guess my kind of one of the kind of concerns that I'm always wrestling with if I start to think about my position in any kind of academic field is, do you risk becoming a, you know, jack of all trades and a master of none? You know, I have an approximate knowledge of four things, but no deep knowledge of any of them. So heaven help me in my vibe if I start to go like, you know, I don't, yeah, that's my kind of worry. I don't know if you have any thoughts on that.
Oh, 100%. Imposter syndrome is stronger for the multidisciplinary person than anyone else. There's no question about it. But you just have to think about like what kind of knowledge is really actually important. This is what I say to console myself, right? A jack of all trades is able to go to places that an expert in one thing can't.
Mm-hmm.
And see more things than the expert can. Just like the expert can see more things than a jack of all trades can. This actually touches on another, you know, axe that I have to grind with the Theological Academy, and it's too individualistic. I think the Theological Academy needs to evolve in a model that's actually more similar to the hard sciences, which is group authored research.
Interesting.
And the jack of all trades is no good if not no good because we're all trying to be jacks of all trades, right? That doesn't help us; it makes us feel worse. The jack of all trades has a gift in terms of seeing how different disciplines piece together, but it can't go too deep into any of them. Do you know what that positions a jack of all trades to do? To convene a Christian ethicist, a practical theologian, and a historian, and get them to speak out of their expertise and their depth and say, okay, I'm going to craft that and put that together into this thing that addresses a question.
Mm-hmm.
And I wouldn't be able to do it without your depth. But you wouldn't be able to put them together. And then let's get a four-authored book or article out that shows how Christian ethics, history, and theology or whatnot engage this issue.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's part of the holism that I'm seeking that I'm hoping for. But it's really hard. It's built in, it's baked into the structure to do that. And
that's really interesting. Yes. I've never considered the idea of like co-authored papers in theology. I don't know why. Maybe I'm just inherently selfish, but it is just very interesting because, I mean, for all that theology or Christian theology talks about, you know, fellowship and the body of believers, we're all like, actually, I have the right answer to who God is, and find out in the latest issue of Modern Theology. Like, that's really interesting. I'd never really considered that. Yeah.
We want to talk about your abductive approach as well. Mm-hmm. And I really enjoyed that piece. Tell us more about that. What do you mean by abductive approach? And maybe speak from your own experience and how that has, how has that been as an approach in your project?
Thanks for asking that question. That's one of those sort of deep methodological nitty-gritty questions that most people don't ask. But you're both very smart people, so that's why you ask it. And not to toot my own horn, but it's the reason I say it's a nitty-gritty thing is because it gets to the fundamental logical posture in which your research comes. And it's true. We're always sort of implicitly taught that there's inductive and there's deductive ways to approach inquiry, right? You can start with a hypothesis and sort of work that out, or you can take a huge body of data and see what naturally emerges, right? And they both have their place. The reason I'm so attracted to abduction is when I was doing my PhD studies at Georgetown, I studied with Becky Hsu, and she introduced me to a scholar by the name of Idil Tavuri, or Tavori. And he and another scholar, Stephen Timmermans, were working on a approach to sociological research that they called abductive analysis. Hmm. And for them, abduction was a way of trying to move past the inductive-deductive binary. And what that meant was what does it mean to generate new perspectives rather than test old perspectives or look for spaces for new perspectives to just naturally emerge? You know, what does it mean to like make new perspectives your actual goal? And what abduction does is it looks for surprises, and then it asks, you know, why was this even surprising to me? You know, why was this unexpected thing happening? And it really asks you to reconfigure all of your variables and what you're studying to deal with the surprise.
Yeah.
Right. And by dealing with the surprise, you're generating a new perspective. You're trying to understand this thing that nobody was thinking about. And I know that's really abstract, but I'll just give you the example from my dissertation and the article that you're referring to in the Journal of Word Christianity. It was basically a really bad draft of my methods chapter. So I look at it now and I'm like, oh, you know, it could have been, you know, it's not really that clear. For me, when I was studying Christianity in China, I had this initially deductive approach, and then sort of bounced back and forth with an inductive approach and trying to figure out the relationship between the two. But when I read this thing about abductive analysis, I was like, oh, okay, let me just think about what surprised me while I was doing these interviews. What a practical, easy way to focus when there are so many possible ways to focus. Let me just look at my interview data and be like, what surprised me? And go over there. And what I found was I was surprised by the difference between Chinese Christians who had international experience and the way they talked about their faith compared with Chinese Christians who had spent all of their lives in China. There seemed to be like a qualitative difference between the way that they were able to talk about their faith and why it was important to them and what it did for their lives. And I was like, that was surprising. I had no intention of looking at that, but it's surprising enough for me that I'm going to follow that. And that's what abductive analysis does. It helps you to follow a surprise.
That kind of leads nicely onto my next kind of area that I would like to talk about, which is Asian American theology. So is this a kind of recent-ish like foray for you? Is this something that you kind of have always been working away with in the back of your mind, and now you're kind of starting to think about it more concretely? Or tell us about your interest in Asian American theologies.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, life is full of contingencies, and you never know what's going to happen. Mm-hmm. And so Asian American theology is personally relevant to me because I am an Asian American. Mm-hmm. And so I exist within that space. But it is not something I've ever bothered to actually go deep into. As a world Christianity scholar, as somebody who studies Chinese Christianity in China, as opposed to Chinese Americans, you know, I wasn't thinking much about Asian American theology. It's actually because I started my job here at the Overseas Ministry Study Center 2 years ago, and I met Dr. David Chow, who is the director of the Center for Asian American Christianity here at Princeton. Mm-hmm. And we just became quick conversation partners because he's also interested in theology and qualitative research, but primarily for Asian American contexts as opposed to world Christianity contexts. So we would have lots of great conversations, and there was a lot of great cross-pollination. And for me, it became my interest in Asian American theology has grown because of, I think, trends in Asian American studies and Asian American theology toward a more trans-Pacific perspective. Mm-hmm. It's not just about Asian Americans in the United States of America or North America. It's about Asian Americans and their relationship to Asians. And these trans-Pacific links, and as a scholar of Chinese Christianity, suddenly looking at that trans-Pacific link becomes much more interesting, and much more important and much more relevant. So that's why I started looking at Asian American theology a little bit more.
So for me, I am convinced of the need for a transnational lens. I think particularly in today's world, you can't ignore it and still call yourself a good scholar. But my kind of question that I always have is, like, is there a danger that we lose sight of the local? Like, do you see a tension in between the kind of deep dive into, call it lived theology, practical theology? Do you see a tension between the kind of almost hyper-focus on, like, a lived experience of faith in a particular context and then the aim to also be transnational? So I'll give the example of my own work. Like, I'm looking at migrant women in diaspora, so there's an immediate transnational connection, but as it is, I haven't really talked about that transnationality because I'm more interested in the woman's interiority. So I think, so for me, I'm kind of like, I find myself almost accidentally picking one over the other, and I wonder if there's a way to do both. Is there a balance? Is there a tension? Is there, or do you need to kind of, how would you kind of navigate that, I guess, is what I'm trying to ask.
Oh, absolutely. It's, I mean, we can't do everything right, and unfortunately everything is there. So I would say very practically, you have to pick one first. You know, there's no way to do both at the same time. And as doctoral students, you pick one and you do it well enough for your advisor's liking. And then you can go move on to the other side of it because they both matter. But you can't do both. And I think the word that I like that I don't remember where I first stumbled upon it. I like the word oscillation or oscillating, like the movement back and forth at a speed that if it's oscillating fast enough, you can't tell that it's moving back and forth between two things. I think a lot of scholarship should be oscillating, like big picture, little picture, you know, local, global. And if you're moving back and forth at a regular enough pace, you see the composite image of both of those. And so even for you, the global elements of migrant women are so important to shaping their lived experience. The problem is the lived experience, they're unless they're being trained in some kind of, you know, scholarly endeavor, they're not going to be able to tell you about some of these global economic structures that are causing their migration. Mm-hmm. But they are 100% a part of their experience. And so the, in addition to the global and the local and oscillating between those two, I would say you also have to oscillate between the edic and the emic, right? The insider and the outsider perspective. Because the insider can't see things that the outsider mm-hmm. can see. And so you do need both. Mm-hmm. And all this to encourage you to eventually get to the other side of things.
I don't know how you found that encouraging. You've just given me more things to think about I have to do in 100,000 words or less.
No, what I'm saying is don't do it now.
No, like, that's true. Yeah. Pick one and
don't,
stick to
totally
it.
Don't worry about it for now. Just keep another set of notes on the other side, and then you'll have something to do when you're done.
I think I'm just dreaming of working a minimum wage job, but being called doctor. That's all I want.
I think there's another tension that often emerges in this consideration of qualitative research in theology, which is the question of normative and descriptive. And there's often the idiom that social sciences are descriptive, whereas theologies tend to be more normative. I'm just wondering, is that necessarily always true? And I do wonder if there's, like you said, about oscillation. I wonder if there's something of a bridge or some happy overlap deep in that two connection where we can probably more comfortably conduct our interdisciplinary exercise between theology and social sciences. I would like to hear reflections on that.
Yeah, the normative descriptive question is a binary that's not easily bridged. And this might not be the answer you're looking for, but it's the one that comes to mind. And this is actually some of my training in Buddhist studies. My PhD at Georgetown was focused on religious pluralism, so we had to do a lot of Buddhist study. Like, since I was studying Christianity in China, they wanted me to study like what are, you know, other religions in China, so mm-hmm. that you can have a comparative point, right? So I did a lot of study in Buddhism, and it has to do with that sort of multi, like, all truths are true somewhere, if that makes any sense. All truths are true somewhere, which means all truths are also wrong somewhere. Like, all truths are untrue somewhere else. Okay, and that for me is sort of what I hold on to when I think about how theology and qualitative research might work within this binary of descriptive and normative. Is you can only get at what's true in that context when you get enough description. But the truth that you find that is really true, you know, this is, you know, God, or this is a fact, is only true in that distinct set of circumstances. Mm-hmm. So if you take that truth and you take it somewhere else, it might not only be untrue, it might be harmful and like yeah. dangerous, even though it's true and helpful over there. So all of a sudden, you have to do a whole different set of descriptive work to figure out what is true there. And so that can seem really, really subjective, but it's actually not. You know, it's yeah. relying on really, really rich contextual thinking. You know, and for me, actually, you know, Buddhist studies, Tiantai studies, and sort of Chan Buddhism. You know, that Buddhist logic was really helpful for me to think that way.
Yeah. Well, I guess we could even problematize this even further, because what is descriptively true in a context now may not be so in, say, even 5 years or even 10 years.
I was going to say there's a time element to it.
Time element too, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And so that descriptive, that hence in the Buddhist logic, you know, nothing is stationary. Mm. Truth is a moving target, but that doesn't mean truth doesn't exist.
Yeah.
And so the descriptive work is ongoing forever, because what was true for Myanmar 10 years ago is definitely no longer true now. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But that's not to say it wasn't true 10 years ago.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. I think the underlying, from what I see, is... So let me frame it in the form of a question. How crucial is the notion, the theology or event of incarnation in this theological program in qualitative research in theology, like incarnational theology, let's call it, the idea of Jesus, who is in a sense universal but becomes radically mm-hmm. local, mm-hmm. The idea of Jesus who is, shall we say, normative? I mean, you understand what I'm trying to say, like the translocal and the local dynamic.
If we turn to, and this is where we get like thick, we get into more theological conversation, yeah. right? Not just the methodological academic disciplines conversation. I was recently reading some work by Daniel Lee at Fuller Theological Seminary, who's an Asian American theologian.
Is this his latest one?
It is his doing Asian American theology, yeah. And I found some of his work very helpful, even related to some of my past thinking about this issue of theology as normative and descriptive, mm. and how do we like theologically piece that together? And often people go to the incarnation, right?
Yeah.
And I would say it's that in Jesus, it's not necessarily that, if we want to use the language, right? It's Jesus is Christ incarnated in a specific form, a very local, very particular form. So the truth of Christ is universal. You know, and I think, okay. you know, many theologians would be able to work with, you know, the word is mm-hmm. universal. But the particular person of Jesus is a specific incarnation of that. And that specific incarnation is to show you that the universality of Christ has a must be particularly embodied, mm-hmm. you know. And Daniel Lee, let me get back to Daniel. Daniel Lee makes an argument that the Jewishness of Jesus is 100% non-negotiable. Mm-hmm. And when you look at the arc of European Christianity, is that they actually try to make Jesus Christ. Christ in this universal sense and Jesus yeah. in this universal sense so that Jesus can be white, black, whatever that Jesus is. But he's like, that's not true. Mm-hmm. Jesus is always Jewish and always particular. And so and this is where I don't want to put words in his mouth. This again comes from my training in religious pluralism. You know, people, when you're getting into Buddhist Christian dialogue, there is a lot of conversation about Christ as a separate thing from Jesus. Mm. You know, Buddhists will talk about the Buddha nature in every person, and those that are engaged in thick sort of conversation will talk about what is the Christ nature in every person, Christ in me, Christ in you, Christ in Jesus. You know, and so then it's this universal truth that is constantly being incarnated within the body of Christ in its particularities, and so there's a deep embracing of particularity as the only way that a universal truth can be communicated.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah. There's a lot of Asian feminist theologians who kind of subscribe to that view, like the particularity of Jesus has no impact on who he is for me as an Asian woman. Like, it's fine. Like, I don't mind using male pronouns, for example. Because that's not the heart of the matter for me as a Christian woman, is what some Asian feminist theologians say, which is mm-hmm. Well, on that light theological note, thank you so much, Easton, for teaching us. Thank you so much for joining us. It's been a really, really fascinating conversation. I'm glad we covered everything and have solved the problem of lived versus systematic theology once and for all. We really enjoyed having you on the show. Thank you so much. Yes.
Well, thank you for this opportunity, and I hope I was intelligible. Sort of my brain jumps around. To refer back to your initial introduction, now you can see maybe in conversation with me why my brain kind of floats around. Like, I'm pretty sure you weren't expecting Buddhist studies to make an appearance here, but it just kind of floated over there,
yep. yeah,
and I was like, well, I guess I'll just. Say something, you know, run with it. And if you found this helpful, let it be an encouragement to you that being a jack of all trades is not a bad thing, because your brain floats over to other things and there's some connections.
Thank you so much.
Great.
Thank you.